From the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end of what's really happening in your old North State.
Welcome back to another edition of Civitalk. What are your thoughts on Silent Sam, Confederate monuments, vigilantism, the rule of law? We're talking about that and a lot more today. How's it going, Brooke?
It's going great, Ray. We do have a lot to talk about this week, and so I'm glad you opened it up with the primary discussion today, which is Silent Sam.
This is a big news story across the state, and of course, in Chapel Hill, there's a lot of division going on. You've got probably a student body that has been browbeaten to some extent. There was an interesting quote in a Carolina Journal article where a young woman, I think she was the chairman of the College Republicans, said that there was a fear to speak out on campus over this issue. But of course, most people are talking about Silent Sam, which had stood on the grounds of the campus, I believe, since 1909.
And it was 1913,
you were right, Brooke. 1913, it was torn down just a few days ago, a week later, as you're listening to this now. But it's a big issue. I mean, this is an issue I lived as a student at Ole Miss because of just Confederate symbols on the campus. So I've got a lot of opinions. I've thought about this for a long time. What are your kind of initial thoughts, Brooke, about what's going on in the controversy?
So you and I have discussed this in the office earlier, and like you, I've been thinking about this for, at least me personally, I've been thinking about it a lot since Charlottesville last year, but even a little bit before that. And although there is a time and a place, and I think the time was happened a long time ago that we should have begun this discussion more seriously and in earnest. However, the setting aside the need for us to have the discussion about the place of Confederate monuments, this vandalism is something that needs to be dealt with, I think, very, very seriously, because it sets a poor precedent. You and I were talking about the law enforcement's decision to stand back and allow this to happen, despite there being adequate law enforcement there on the UNC campus when the protesters were there. And so I think that's very problematic. What do you think about that?
Well, one of my favorite movies is the Oxbow Incident with Henry Fonda. I think it was filmed in the late 1930s, maybe early 1940s. And it had to do with the dangers of vigilantism, the loss of the rule of law, things like that. And it just shows you what can happen when the mob rules. It's been a long time since I've seen this movie, but I think, you know, ends up being three or four people end up being hanged that are innocent because of just the loss of the rule of law and things of that nature. So to me, there's so many layers to look at in terms of this controversy. I think the first main thing is that anytime you have sort of this vigilante justice, this loss of the rule of law is very detrimental to the Republic. This is not how we deal with issues in the public square. We don't take matters into our own hand, destroy property, specifically public property like this that was funded by the Daughters of the Confederacy. The money was raised, and so it just has this specific incident that I think has to be dealt with to some degree. It's one thing if you disagree with Silent Sam or you want to see it come down, but there's a process for that, and you know, I would argue that the monument should stay up because these things need to be contextualized. And you know, at UNC, these Confederate soldiers were students at one time, and I think that's who they're paying homage to. And you can argue that that's right or wrong, but it's just a fact of history, and I think you need to address that in some way. And I think having a monument, I think sometimes we're trying to read race back into that from 40, 50, 60 years ago with this post-civil rights movement viewpoint, and kind of say, oh, well, this is, you know, we're judging everybody from the past by today's standards, what I think is a wrong thing. I know you and I talked about, well, what if we decided to tear statues down of abortion, people who supported abortion 50, 60 years from now, because we become more enlightened and realize just how heinous and evil that practice is. And, you know, but even if we disagree with abortion, we shouldn't go around tearing down monuments for people who were pro-abortion, you know.
So I think I think there are a couple of things that are warrant discussion when it comes to Confederate monuments. And like you said, there may come a time in history when we look on, let's say, a Margaret Sanger statue or bust. We, you and I being pro-lifers, we already look at that and think, okay, this symbolizes racism and eugenics and things like that. But for the broader society, one day, hopefully, they'll kind of begin to look at the Sanger statues in the same way. But the thing is, it has historical context is something that I think is largely lacking from the conversation at large. The UNC students, or even those that were there that weren't students, because I think there was a significant number of them that weren't even students there at UNC. I think that they haven't been brought in on the actual historical perspective when it comes to this this monument and others. I think there is a case to be made, and I know some in our audience won't agree with me on this. I think there's a case to be made, though, about moving these statues to either private property or museums. Because there is some context there that I believe we need to be intellectually honest about, especially when it comes to the dedication of Silent Sam and the funding of it and things like that. You and I happen to disagree on that, I think, to an extent. Am I correct in saying that?
I would just ask you this, Brooke, to take a counterpoint. Is there space in the public square? We certainly have it in Raleigh. We certainly have it in other places across the state, certainly in rural counties all across North Carolina. I mean, that's the, you know, one of the seminal symbols in the town squares in many southern cities is that Confederate soldier. He's kind of defiantly posed to the north, but he's this fixture, this monument in the public square. Is there a symbol for honoring the common soldier? I'm not talking about honoring the Confederacy or honoring slavery. There are many people who fought for the South that were against slavery. There were many generals, but there were many common soldiers that didn't own slaves. I mean, most people who fought for the Confederacy didn't own slaves. So is there space in the public square to allow recognition of people's ancestors that fought in this lost cause, if you want to call it, you certainly can call it a lost cause, that sacrificed their lives or lost their livelihood? Just, you know, even if we disagree with the war now, can we at least say, hey, there's people that actually took up arms, fought, died, and they deserve some kind of recognition?
Absolutely. I think there is a space for that. And history is messy, right? We'll look at our own time. 50 years from now, people will talk about the 2016 election and just the politics right now where we're at and realize it's messy and we can't overgeneralize things on either side. But I do think that there is a case to be made that if these monuments remain in public spaces, and like you said, especially in rural parts of our state, where there are people that maybe have generations of North Carolinians in their family that did fight for the Confederacy, is there a way that we can incorporate both sides of history where we pay homage to those in our family that maybe fought on the Confederacy side? And I say our, but I'm not from this area. However, those that are from this area, where they can honor them while still recognizing that there was a broader perspective too when it came to, I know the Civil War was fought about a number of things, but also the issue of slavery. So we're contextualizing it correctly as well and realizing this, these were erected sometimes during the Jim Crow era. And a lot of minorities, especially blacks, would interpret that as just a form of intimidation that they were erected during that time period. And so I think that we need to respectfully listen to one another on this issue.
One of the best books I read was Uneasy Burden by Andrew Young. And Andrew Young was a lieutenant of Martin Luther King. He was a former congressman from Georgia later in his life. Still alive. I think he's in his late 80s now. But he was mayor of Atlanta for some time. And Andrew Young had some very prescient, you know, when all this was going down in Charlottesville, Virginia, he had some very prescient comments, I think, about Confederate monuments. He said, really, this is not an important issue or shouldn't be an important issue to the black community. I thought he made some good points. He's like, fundamentally, and Andrew Young's kind of been known as a moderate for most of his career. Even when he was working with King, he was kind of seen as a little bit more of a moderate member of King's inner circle. But he said, you know, these Confederate monuments are really just distractions to the black community. It's people, the media in many ways going out and rousing this issue up, almost begging for these monuments to come down. I think that was one thing I saw And I don't want to call out specifically reporters by name, but I saw some people from the News and Observer seem to be cheering that the monuments were coming down on Twitter and on social media. And so I think there's a lot of fomenting division in the media on this issue. I mean, for me, and I want to get to your point in just a second about contextualizing these, but I think part of the problem on this issue is the media fomenting division on Confederate monuments. And, you know, it's just something that happened in our history. There were some great people that fought for the Confederacy. There were some evil people that fought for Confederacy. Nathan Bedford Forrest was one that would probably definitely be on the more evil side. And then you had people like Beauregard in New Orleans, who was did some good things for the black community in New Orleans after he left, after he was no longer a Confederate general. So I think you just have to contextualize these to some degree. And in contextualizing them, you know, at Ole Miss, we have a Confederate monument. It's been somewhat controversial, although there's been a few instances of vandalism, but I don't think anybody's tried to take it down per se. But, you know, we've contextualized things by James Meredith, who was the first black student to enter Ole Miss in the early 1960s during the Kennedy administration. I mean, it was this huge thing that 82nd Airborne had to be sent in to integrate the school. But they put up a statue a few years ago of James Meredith, who he didn't want the statue up there, but they put it up anyways. I think he's changed his mind to some degree. But I think, you know, there's space for both monuments, for dedication to the common soldier that fought for the Confederacy, and certainly civil rights leaders. I know that Richmond added Arthur Ashe, and there may be others, because, you know, Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy, so they have monuments downtown to some of the Confederate generals and Confederate figures. But they've also added figures like Arthur Ashe, who is a famous black tennis player.
Yeah, I think that, you know, just even citing the Ole Miss example, where there is a monument to someone who was part of the black community or is part of the black community, and just recognizing both sides of this and just how nuanced and messy history is. I know I said it earlier, too, and I just think that there is so much to be said about understanding individual stories and not treating everyone with the same broad brush, and realizing that they, just like us nowadays, are kind of a mixed bag when it comes to good characteristics and those that we'll look later on in our life and realize, wow, was I wrong or off base in that area? So our appeal is to ourselves and our listeners that we handle this conversation, because it is a hot topic, with respect to other points of view, while still being able to be persuasive about our own perspective. Both Ray and I definitely are making the case that vandalism should not be tolerated in any uncertain terms, but also inviting people to have an honest dialogue about the context of each of these monuments, because there is different history behind different monuments and figures during that era. So, loaded subject. We want to hear from you, though. Please feel free to go ahead and reach out to us at radio@nccivitas.org and shoot us an email. Tell us what you think, and we'll read your comments on the air. And but with that being said, let's go ahead and move on. We just had a poll lunch, didn't we?
Yeah. What did you take away from the poll lunch? Because I had a few thoughts. I'd love to hear from you first. But I would like to hear what you thought about what you saw today.
So I thought that the poll lunch was on unaffiliated voters in our state, which is the largest growing voting bloc in the state. It is comprises 31.5% of the voting population, or those that are registered. And so huge block of people, but they are by no means monolithic. So that was one huge takeaway, was that although unaffiliated voters are some might want to think that they are moderate and they're kind of in between the Democratic and Republican parties, what our poll results revealed was that no, they are very much determined to vote in one direction or another when it comes to political ideology. They just don't want to wear that party label. So we had representatives from the Democratic Party and the Republican one. So Dallas Woodhouse on the Republican side and Matt Hughes on the Democratic side. And they gave their perspectives too. And I thought it was fascinating just to hear how they interpreted the unaffiliated sentiments. But I'll let you share some of the biggest takeaways from that poll.
I think the biggest takeaway by far was the three constitutional amendments that, you know, Civitas supports: voter ID, the tax cap, and the right to fish and hunt. Total support from unaffiliated for voter ID was 63%, for right to hunt and fish was 65%, and for the income tax cap to be dropped from 10 to 7% was 60%. So that was a little bit higher than I thought. I knew that those are very popular amendments, but since we're talking about unaffiliated voters, to me that kind of jumped out. Nothing else was really that much of a surprise. The Democrats have lead on the generic ballot test, and I suspect we'll probably see that all the way up to Election Day. I don't expect that to change, but those three constitutional amendments were good. I thought it was also the wordplay. When people thought about a certain party, they gave them an opportunity to respond in one word. Democratic Party, the first thing people talked about was negative or disapproving view. Republican Party was conservative. But you also had some smaller ones in there, like socialism for the Democratic Party, too liberal, some positives maybe for the people. Here's a funny one, babies/snowflakes. Lack of leadership. You had some expletives in there, pro-abortion, Maxine Waters, but also Thomas Jefferson and Nancy Pelosi. So to me, that was kind of neat to see some people's one-word responses. For the Republican Party, you had racist in there. You had pro-life, dislike, power-hungry, crooks, backwards, small-minded, downward spiral, Second Amendment, make America great again, off-track, out-of-touch, fiscal conservative, white supremacy, garbage. So there's some interesting adjectives in there.
To be sure. Yes, there were. I thought that was interesting, too. So if you want to look at this word cloud for both parties, they are on our Twitter, which our Twitter handle is at NC Civitas. And yeah, I think that was helpful in getting a visual of the way that unaffiliated voters characterize the different parties, which can probably explain, especially after Ray read you those negative ones from both parties, that can explain why people have chosen to identify as unaffiliated. I think that that voting block has, they don't have positive views by and large of the particular, the two parties, which is why they've chosen to break away from them. But that doesn't mean that they're political philosophy or even ideology is outside of the Democratic or Republican platforms. Many Republicans support voter ID, right to hunt and fish, and income tax cap lowering. Well, it seems like a lot of unaffiliateds do too. However, more unaffiliateds are planning on voting for Democrats if you're looking at just the generic ballot as of right now. So these are some interesting things. So they're still splitting one way or another.
Yeah,
on
and there's
issues.
Still a lot of undecided in those generic ballots.
There are,
I think
yep.
Like 20-something percent. So there's flexibility for Republicans to gain ground, for Democrats to even open up a bigger lead. So to me, that'll be interesting to watch. We'll continue with our polling for Civitas. And I expect more and more, as the growth of millennials and younger voters start to take more of a position of power and prestige in this nation and in leadership positions, that you're just going to see more and more people leaving the two main parties and become unaffiliated.
Do you think one of the reasons why that is that as the millennial generation becomes a more prominent voter demographic is one of the reasons they're less likely to identify with a party is the same reason that they're less likely to be part of civil associations, volunteer groups, and things like that, where they rally around ideas per se, mm-hmm. but not necessarily around groups.
Yeah, Brooke, you made my point. I think that's one of the crises in our nation is the kind of the collapse of civil society in many ways. And one of the negatives of that is when civil society starts to erode, government starts to gain ground because somebody has to pick up the slack. When charities, when philanthropic organizations begin to sort of wane, then somebody has to pick up the slack there. And in most cases in history, when that happens, the government becomes more powerful, it becomes bigger, just has more control over people's lives. So I think that's something to watch as we move forward. And I think it's, how many people our age, especially your age, Brooke, not that you're like, light years younger than me, but how many people are
members? I mean, I'm a good 10 years younger. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
How many people are members of like Rotary though? And,
I don't
Kiwanis?
Know anyone my age that's...
Yeah, I know a couple people, but very few people are members of those groups anymore.
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing a bit, also this has to do with the social media generation. People have no problem joining groups on there. Right. I think that
Yeah, because it doesn't really cost anything to join a group.
It doesn't, which is kind of scary, too. Yeah. So you're not getting participation at these large levels that you would if they were in a group that they actually had to show up with, which is no wonder, I guess, civil discourse has eroded in a lot of ways because engagement is often happening online where we're not looking one another in the eye. We don't have to really suffer the consequences.
I'm really nasty to Brooke on Twitter and on Facebook.
So mean. I cry every night. But there's this erosion that we're seeing, and it's up to my generation, your generation, and Gen Z, or the I generation, to really recognize that this is detrimental to the way that we're interacting with one another. And if we want to actually make headway, we talk a lot about peace and unity and loving one another. If we really believe that, though, we're going to have to make some changes.
I think so. I think you're exactly right. And the poll results, to me, I think one of the things just moving forward is to see, you know, anytime your Republican Party is out of power or just any major party is out of power, like the Democrats are in terms of Congress and the White House, they usually pick up gains. I mean, when the president is in his first full term, they lose a lot of seats. So it'll be interesting to see if Republicans can mitigate that from state to state across the nation at the national level. I think in 2008, I was reading the New York Times, their political story. Democrats lost like 800 legislative seats, state legislative seats in 2008 when Obama, you know, was struggling. In
right. Each party plays its own role in checking the other one. And so, like you said, it wouldn't be super surprising. Yeah, it wouldn't be super surprising to see majorities, the majority party decrease in their influence come this election. But I guess we'll see. We'll be keeping our finger on the pulse and we'll continue to do polling all the way up until the election. But let's switch gears again. We're running out of time. So I want to really talk about this, at least cover.
Let's do
this Institute for Justice lawsuit. So we, a few weeks ago, spoke about that Certificate of Need lawsuit and Dr. Singh and Institute for Justice defending him and just basically asserting that con laws, Certificate of Need laws, are unconstitutional because it establishes a monopoly in the state at the medical, when it comes to medical services and equipment. However, this has to do with food trucks in Carolina Beach. So,
what's your favorite food truck?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I don't do a lot of food trucks unless I'm at the State Fair, which I can't wait till that comes around again. And I don't even know the name of it, but the one that does deep fried Pop-Tarts. And it's got like powdered sugar and jelly on top and then deep fried Reese's. It's amazing. So anyways, I am a big fan of food trucks when they are within walking distance of wherever I'm at. But Carolina Beach food trucks, there have been, apparently the town was restricting or has and continues to restrict whether or not food truck owners from neighboring towns may actually sell and do business in their town. So it's establishing a monopoly, essentially. And so Institute for Justice and these food truck owners from outside towns are saying, hey, that's not fair. That's unconstitutional. So we're gonna make sure that this gets set right. So any thoughts on that?
Well, I think the big problem is, you know, anytime these food trucks get kicked out of areas, it's all because people don't want competition. So there's a market factor and an impact to that that is discouraging when somebody decides, you know, this has to do with Uber and yellow cabs, or it has to do with Airbnb and hotels. They don't want any sort of competition in the marketplace. So the easiest thing to do is pass some kind of ordinance that said, nope, no food trucks allowed. And I think that's discouraging. I know a lot of urban areas across this country have done that, where food trucks have taken off dramatically. But to me, I just think I look at it from a free market aspect. Everybody should have an opportunity to compete in the marketplace as long as they're following other laws in terms of health codes and things. And food trucks are generally pretty good about that. So why shouldn't they get an opportunity if there is a market for them to be able to compete, to put out their product there? So to me, it's just discouraging that they would even pass an ordinance to try to ban them.
Well, and doesn't it incentivize the other food truck owners that are from Carolina Beach to actually do better and offer better products, maybe lower prices? I mean, there's that argument to be made that when we have competition, we're either going to sink or swim, and we should actually be able to exist based on our merits and what we offer to the market, rather than having government step in and prevent others from actually competing with us. So there's a moral aspect to that too.
Yeah, there's definitely a moral aspect too. Just allowing people to flourish and cultivate the trade that they're in, and to go out and make a living for them and their family. And anytime you discourage that, I think it just, you run into that aspect of sort of plunder and taking away somebody's ability on their livelihood to provide for their family.
Yeah. So I applaud IJ. And
they've been really good with their lawsuits. The ones that they pick, they've been, like we mentioned in the last podcast, I think they were 4 for 5 winning cases at the Supreme Court. And the one that they lost was the Keough versus New Haven, which became, there's a recent movie out about that. I think it's called Pink Houses. It has to do with eminent domain. So they won the battle of public opinion, even though they lost the case at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, hats off to them. We're excited that they're taking these on, and we'll be sure to continue to follow it. But let's close out with this story. Donald Bryson, our president, actually wrote an article on this at nccivitas.org, and it is entitled, "Cooper Administration Hurricane Recovery Efforts Still Have Eastern North Carolina Underwater." So we were writing about this earlier this week, and it has to do with Cooper visiting Fair Bluffs, North Carolina, which was hit very hard by Hurricane Matthew, and still the economy is suffering there. The residents are suffering, still waiting for emergency assistance. And that's, I think, what, 99 weeks since Governor McCrory at the time declared it an emergency. And Governor Cooper was invited by the mayor of Fair Bluffs to speak to the citizens and just connect with them and assure them and reassure them that help was indeed on its way, because there are millions of state dollars that were granted for recovery efforts, and yet Fair Bluffs and other Eastern North Carolina cities haven't seen them, or they haven't seen the completion of the projects that these were supposed to fund. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts going back to the last election, I mean, whether you were for Cooper or McCrory, one of the things I was really impressed, coming from a hurricane state in Mississippi, lived through Katrina, although I left kind of the couple days before it hit. But I mean, I left to go back to seminary, and I just remember my dad was out of, my parents were out of town, and my dad was like, just get out of there. And, you know, I came back to the devastation and saw what it was like. For me, I think Cooper just has to be more involved. I'm actually, I understand the bureaucratic side, that maybe, you know, you don't blame him so much for some of the slowness of what's happening on the bureaucratic side with the federal government. He may be more to blame. Maybe I just haven't followed it close enough. But I think what is really kind of low about Cooper in this instance is he's not willing to go down and talk to these people. He does a few photo ops, but he, you know, the mayor said, hey, I want you to come down and just speak to the residents. And he said, no, I'm not an expert. He kind of, and he said, I just, it wouldn't do any good. And I think he just doesn't want to answer any tough questions on this.
And it has to do, so I think the mayor, in inviting him, this is just my guess, wanted him to boost the morale of that small town.
Right, people want to hear from their governor.
So they weren't expecting an expert to come.
Yeah.
And so it almost creates this bad optics. And Donald ended his article with saying, Governor Cooper may genuinely care for the people of Eastern North Carolina, but the actions of his administration indicate indifference, or at least an incompetent lack of urgency. And that's the flaw that people have found with his decision to not speak to those residents.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit, after Katrina, Haley Barbour did such a good job in Mississippi, and Kathleen Blanco didn't do a good job. She was blaming people or doing this and that. Cooper is just, I don't think he's cared enough about this issue and has been quite as engaged. So it'll be an important issue for that part of the state for him to just sort of, I think, just pay a little bit closer attention and actually go down and talk to residents. He said, you know, he made some comment in the media about finding the time. It's like, it should just be priority number one to go down there. So, you know, I'll continue to monitor it. I know you will too, but I'd love to see just a little bit more of engaged governor, because anybody who's survived a natural disaster or hurricane, it's just very disheartening, and it's, you're almost paralyzed by what's going on. So you do need some kind of help. You need someone to come in and really resonate with what you're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just hope that he learns from this and from the criticism and begins to handle this better next time. But we are out of time, and we want to just thank you all for listening this week. And hopefully you will join us again next week. We'll have a great lineup, and we will be talking about the issues of the day as well as the week. We're about to hit a special session or an extra session when it comes to the constitutional amendments. So be tuned in next week for some analysis on that. So thanks for joining.
Thank you for listening to Civit Talk, and find us at nccivitas.org.